Miss Smith sighed. Ada, can't we have a happy night? Can't we drink cocoa and be happy together? I know I said I didn't want evacuees, but I've explained. It wasn't anything to do with you. I didn't not choose you. Everyone else did. I put my mug down. I hate cocoa, I said, and went to bed. It was Miss Smith, not me, who saw the welt on Jamie's wrist. Chapter 18. We were having dinner. Jamie reached across the table for another piece of bread, and Miss Smith grabbed his arm. "What's that?" she asked. When she pushed his sleeve back, I saw the deep red mark on Jamie's wrist. It reminded me of when I'd tied him up in our flat. Only worse. His skin had been rubbed away until it bled. It looked awful. Jamie snatched his arm back. "Nothing," he said, pushing his cuff back down. "That's not nothing," Miss Smith said. "What happened?" He wouldn't say. "Did somebody hurt you?" I asked. "Somebody tie you up? Some boy at school?" Jamie looked at his plate. He shrugged. "Oh, honestly," Miss Smith said. "Speak up. You can't let people bully you. Tell us what's wrong so we can help you." He wouldn't talk, not then, nor later, to me in the bed. "You've got to tell me," I coaxed. "I take care of you, remember?" He wouldn't tell. At lunch the next day, Miss Smith surprised me by saying, "Ada, would you like to come with me to take Jamie to school? We might do a bit of shopping on the way home." I was worried enough about Jamie that I nodded, even though I suspected her of plans involving velvet. Miss Smith marched Jamie into the school building the way I supposed she always did. I stayed outside. "We'll go get a cup of tea," she said when she returned, "and come back in half an hour." We went to a tea shop, which was a place full of tables where you could buy things to eat and drink, like a pub, only without beer, and cleaner. "Miss," I whispered, taking my seat, "why are there blankets on the tables?" "They're called tablecloths," Miss Smith whispered back. "They're to make the tables look nice." "Huh," I thought. "Imagine dressing up tables. Imagine wasting cloth to dress up tables." A lady came over, and Miss Smith asked for scones and a pot of tea. I remembered to put my napkin on my lap and to say thank you to the lady when she brought the tea, and the lady smiled and said, "What nice manners. She's an evacuee." I didn't know how the lady could tell, and I didn't like it that she could. Miss Smith said, "It's your accent. You talk different from us country people." "I talk different from posh people," is what she meant. I knew I did, and I didn't like it either. I was trying the best I could to sound like I fit in. When we finished our tea, we went back to the school. Miss Smith walked right into the building without saying anything. She marched down the hall and threw open the first classroom door. She didn't knock. I caught up to her just as she sucked in her breath. I looked inside and saw what she saw. The whole class, including Jamie, was working at their desks with pencils and paper. Jamie's left hand was tied to his chair. It was tied tight, even though he already had a bloody welt on his wrist. When I'd tied him up, at least I had let him go right away. Miss Smith said, "What is the meaning of this?" in a voice that made some of the little girls jump. Jamie saw us. His face flooded red. Miss Smith went to him and untied his arm. Jamie ducked. He ducked like he expected her to hit him, the way I ducked sometimes. Miss Smith said, "Jamie, I'm so sorry. I should have come sooner," and put her arms around him. Jamie leaned against her. He started to sob. All this time I'd stood frozen in the doorway. Most of the students sat frozen at their desks. The only sounds were Jamie crying and Miss Smith murmuring words I couldn't quite understand. The teacher unfroze herself with a jerk. She advanced on Miss Smith, eyes blazing.
"I'll thank you not to interfere," she said. "Every time my back's turned, he's using that hand of his. I won't have it. I wouldn't have to tie him if he'd obey me."
Miss Smith held her ground. Her eyes glittered.
"Why shouldn't he use that hand?"
The teacher gasped. I didn't recognize her, though I suppose she'd been on our train. She was an older woman with grey hair braided around her head, and round wire eyeglasses and a skirt that was too tight. When she gasped, her mouth went perfectly round, like her glasses. She looked like a fish.
"It's his left hand," she said. "Everyone knows that's the mark of the devil. He wants to write with his left hand, not his right. I'm training him up the way he's supposed to be."
"I never heard such rubbish," snapped Miss Smith. "He's left-handed, that's all."
"It's the mark of the devil," insisted the teacher.
Miss Smith took a deep breath.
"When I was at Oxford," she said, "my professor of divinity, Dr. Henry Leighton Googe, was left-handed. It is not the mark of the devil. Dr. Googe told me himself that fear of left-handedness was nothing more than silly superstition and unwarranted prejudice. There's nothing in the Bible against people using their left hands. We can write and ask him, if you like. Meanwhile, you will allow Jamie to use whichever hand he prefers, or I shall take action for the wounds he's received."
I hated when she spoke with such big words. I couldn't follow it. Jamie's teacher said, suspiciously,
"When were you at Oxford?"
"I graduated 1931, Miss Smith replied. The teacher looked flustered, but she didn't back down all the way.
"You're not to come into my classroom without knocking," she said. "It isn't allowed."
"I won't again, so long as I have no cause," Miss Smith said. She hugged Jamie to her, then stood.
"I'll be asking Jamie. I don't want him ridiculed, looked down upon, or punished in any way for using his left hand."
The teacher sniffed. Miss Smith stood and guided me to follow her out. I wanted to wait in the hall to be sure the teacher didn't immediately tie Jamie back up. But Miss Smith said we needed to leave. "I've knocked her pride a bit," she said. "We need to let her get it back." I didn't see why. I said, "I could have told them he hates being tied." But I didn't really understand why the teacher tied him, and I said so. Miss Smith sighed.
"Ada, which hand do you eat with?"
"When you hold a fork." I held up my right hand.
"This one."
"Why?
Why not use both?"
"This one feels better," I said.
"That's right. And Jamie eats with his other hand, his left hand. He always does. That hand feels better to him."
I guess he did, but I'd never noticed. I'd never cared.
So,
he's learning to write now, and it's much harder to write with the hand you don't eat with. I'll show you when we get home. She opened the main door of the school, and we went out. A chill wind swirled some dead leaves around the steps. "In the Bible, the good people stand on God's right, and the bad people stand on the left, before they get cast into hell. So, some people..."
"Idiots," I supplied.
"Yes," she smiled at me. "Some idiots think left-handedness comes from the devil. It doesn't. It comes from the brain."
"Like the man you were talking about," I said.
"What?"
"Oh, Dr. Googe."
"Yes, he's Regius Professor of Divinity at Oxford University, where I studied."
"And he's left-handed, like Jamie?"
Miss Smith snorted.
"I've no idea. I didn't read Divinity. I never met the man."
She'd lied. I looked at her sideways. So you didn't go to Oxford, I said,
wherever that was, whatever it meant.
Of course I did, she said. I studied maths.
We walked down the road.
Is a clubfoot like that? I asked.
Like being left-handed?
In a way, it's something you're born with.
No, I mean, is it what that teacher said? A mark of the devil?
It would explain everything, I thought.
Ada, of course not. How could you think so?
I shrugged.
I thought maybe that was why Mam hated me.
Miss Smith's hand touched my shoulder. When she spoke, her voice was uneven.
She doesn't. I'm sure it's not.
She stopped walking and turned to face me.
I don't know what to say, she said, after a pause. I don't want to tell you a lie, and I don't know the truth.
It was maybe the most honest thing anyone had ever said to me.
If she does hate you, she's wrong to do so, Miss Smith said.
I shook that off. It didn't matter, did it? Lee skittered around the tips of my crutches. My bad foot swung in the air. I started down the road again, and after a moment Miss Smith followed.
"Will you ride Butter when we get home?" she asked.
"I think so," I said. "I still can't make him trot."
"Persistence," Miss Smith said. "That's what Lady Thornton says."
I'd asked. Persistence meant to keep trying.
Chapter 19. The very next day, before Jamie went to school, Miss Smith took us to the post office to register for our identity cards. It was a war thing. We would all get cards to carry with us, so that if the Germans invaded, the government could tell who was German and who was English, by asking to see our identity cards. They could also tell because the Germans would be speaking a different language. That's what Miss Smith said. While we stood in line, she explained that all over the world people spoke different. Not just different the way I sounded different from Miss Smith and Maggie, but different, like actual different words. Jamie wanted to hear different words, so Miss Smith told us some. She said they were in Latin, the only other language she knew. "But it's a dead language," she said. "Nobody speaks it anymore." Clearly this wasn't true, since she had just been speaking it, but I didn't say so. Jamie asked,
"If we kill all the Germans, then their language will be dead. Bam!"
He pretended to shoot a German. Miss Smith pursed her lips, but we'd gotten to the front of the line, so she didn't reprimand him. Instead, she told the registry man her name, her birthday, and that she wasn't married and didn't have a job. Then she pushed us forward. "Ada Smith and James Smith," she said. "They're living with me." The registry man smiled. "Niece and nevy, are they? Must be nice to have family staying. I can see the resemblance, sure enough. The girl has your eyes."
"No," Miss Smith said. "They're evacuees. The surname is just a coincidence. I don't know their birth dates," she continued. "It wasn't on their paperwork, and the children couldn't tell me." The man frowned.
"A great big lass and lad like that, and they don't know their own birthdays.
Are they simple?"
I stuck my right foot behind my left and stared at the floor.
"Of course not," Miss Smith snapped. "What an ignorant thing to say."
The man didn't seem put off by her tone.
"Well, that's very nice, I'm sure," he said. "But what am I supposed to put down on the form? The government wants proper birthdays. There isn't a spot for don't know."
"Write down April 5th, 1929 for Ada," Miss Smith said, after asking me how much I could remember about Jamie being a baby. She'd decided long ago I must be 10. "For Jamie, put February 15th. She looked down at us. 1933, she said. We're pretty sure he's 6 years old. The man raised an eyebrow, but did as she told him.
"What's all that mean?" I asked, when we were back out on the street.
"Birthdays are days you get presents," Jamie said gloomily, "and cake for tea, and at school you get to wear the birthday hat."
I remembered Miss Smith asking us about birthdays when we first came to her, but I'd never heard about a birthday hat.
Turns out it was a school thing.
At Jamie's school, his teacher posted birthdays on a big calendar, and when it was your birthday, you wore a hat, and everybody made a fuss over you. When Jamie'd said he didn't know his birthday, his class had laughed at him. He hadn't told us that.
"But now we have birthdays," Jamie said contentedly.
"What you told the man, I'll tell teacher this afternoon and she'll write it on her calendar."
He smiled at Miss Smith.
"What was it?"
"February 15th, 1933," Miss Smith said.
"It's not your real birthday," I said.
"Close enough," Miss Smith said. "February 15th was my father's birthday. Jamie can use it."
"Is your father dead?"
"No," Miss Smith said. "At least, not so I've heard. I think my brothers would tell me."
"It doesn't matter if Jamie shares. There are only 365 days in the year, and there are a lot more people in the world than that. Lots of people have the same birthdays."
"But it isn't Jamie's real birthday," I said.
"No, it's not."
Miss Smith turned and bent over, so she was looking directly at me.
"When I find out your real birthdays, I'll change your identity cards, okay? Promise."
"Okay."
I didn't mind a temporary lie.
"How do you find out?"
Miss Smith's nostrils narrowed.
"Your mother knows. When she answers my letters, she'll tell us."
"Could be a long time then. I doubted I'd ever go to school and wear a birthday hat. But still..."
"Will we have cake for tea on my birthday, on the day you told the man?"
"Yes," Miss Smith said.
A sudden look of sadness washed over her face, then disappeared so quickly that if I hadn't been looking right at her, I never would have seen it.
"Sadness?" I thought. How did I know that was sadness? And why would Miss Smith be sad?
"That was Becky's birthday," Miss Smith said. "It'll be nice to have a reason to celebrate the day again."
"That's a lie," I said. I wasn't angry about it, but it was one.
"Oh," Miss Smith forced a laugh, "it is, and it isn't. It will be hard for me, but I'd like very much to be happy again."
Chapter 20. Stephen White and his colonel invited me to tea. They sent me a proper invitation, written out by post, and Miss Smith handed it to me without opening it. I stared and stared at the marks on the paper, but I couldn't make sense of them. Neither could Jamie, no matter how hard he tried.
"The writing's wiggly," he said, "not like in books."
So I had to ask Miss Smith, which made me angry. She read it out. "Tea, Stephen and the Colonel, Saturday, October 7th. And all the while I grew angrier and angrier that I couldn't read the words myself. Miss Smith looked up at me and laughed.
"Ada, what a face," she said. "It's your own fault. I'm happy to teach you."
Easy for her to laugh. What if I tried and found out I really couldn't learn?
"I'll write back an answer for you," Miss Smith said.
"You want to go, don't you?"
"No,"
I said. I didn't want her having to write for me.
"Why not? You'll have something nice to eat, I'm sure. And Stephen's your friend. The Colonel's an old man, but he's kind and has some interesting stories."
No, I said. I added, Stephen's not my friend.
Miss Smith sat down and looked at me. You told me he carried you to the train station, she said. That sounds like something a friend would do.
Maybe.
The way you helped Margaret Thornton when she was hurt, you were a friend to her the way Stephen was a friend to you.
I didn't want to count Maggie as a friend. I guessed I wouldn't mind counting Stephen as one, only it was harder to be friends with someone who helped you than someone you'd helped.
I know how to behave nicely, Miss Smith continued. You did when we went out for tea the other day. And I'd walk you to the Colonel's house and pick you up again when you were through. You wouldn't be there very long, perhaps an hour. You'd have a treat and a cup of tea and talk. That would be all. I scowled.
Why do you want me to go?
She sighed, air coming out her nose, so she sounded like butter.
I don't care what you do. Only I thought you'd like to be around someone your own age for a change, and I was happy for you that you'd gotten the invitation.
I swallowed. I didn't feel happy. I felt something else.
Scared?
I didn't know.
I don't want to go, I said. You don't have to write anything.
I have to write and decline the invitation, Miss Smith said. You've got to answer either way.
I hadn't known that, of course. I kicked at the chair leg with my good foot while she got out paper and a pen. She wrote something down, then shoved it toward me.
That says, Miss Smith regrets that she is unable to accept your kind invitation for October 7th. That's how you say no politely, and quit kicking the chair. I kicked harder. I didn't care if I was polite or not.
I don't need the Colonel staring at my foot, I said.
How could he? Miss Smith asked. She grabbed my good foot and held it still. I said, stop it. And the Colonel wouldn't be staring at you under any circumstances. He can't see much of anything. He's gone blind. On the actual day of the 7th, it rained, cold and hard. I couldn't ride. Miss Smith gave Jamie scissors and a magazine with pictures of planes in it, and he was happy cutting them out and then flying them around on the rug. I didn't have anything to do.
I couldn't have gone to that stupid tea anyhow, I said.
Miss Smith looked up from her sewing machine. She'd found some old towels and was turning them into dressing gowns for Jamie and me. Dressing gowns were like coats you put on over your pajamas in winter when you weren't in bed. It wasn't winter cold yet, but it was cold enough that Miss Smith had lit the coal fire in the living room. That and the kitchen range kept the house warm.
We'd have used my big umbrella, Miss Smith said. You still could have gone.
Can I go now? I asked. Miss Smith shook her head.
Once you've given your answer, you can't change your mind, she said. It's not polite.
I don't care about polite.
Maybe not, she said crisply, but the Colonel does, and tea parties are about being polite. I stomped my crutch. It landed on one of Jamie's paper planes, smashing it into the rug. Jamie howled. I didn't care.
Miss Smith got up.
What's wrong with you?
My stomach hurts.
You're angry, she said, but you can't take it out on Jamie. Say you're sorry and see if you can fix that plane.
I'm not sorry, I said. Miss Smith pressed her eyes shut.
Say it anyhow, she said.
No.
Jamie, come here.
Miss Smith sat down on the sofa and opened her arms, and Jamie crawled into her lap. Ever since she'd hugged him in his classroom, he'd been cuddling up to her. I could hardly stand it.
Your sister's having a hard time, Miss Smith told him. She didn't mean to rip your plane.
I wanted to say I did too,
only it was such a lie. I never meant to hurt Jamie. He just sometimes got in the way. But looking at him curled up on Miss Smith's lap made me want to scream. Nobody did that for me. Except that Miss Smith patted the space beside her.
"Sit down," she said. "No, really, sit." And then she put her arm around me and pulled me halfway over.
She did. I was almost on her lap.
"You're so stiff," she said. "It's like trying to comfort a piece of wood."
It felt very odd to have her touch me. Of course, it made me tense. But I didn't go away inside my head. I sat on the sofa with Miss Smith's arm around me and Jamie breathing soft near my shoulder, and I watched the coal fire flicker, and I stayed right there in that room, and none of us moved for half an hour. Jamie fell asleep, and Miss Smith and I just sat, neither of us saying a word, until it was time to put the blackout up and make tea.
Chapter 21
Butter refused to ever do anything but walk. I was nice to him. I tried hard not to smack him, even when his laziness angered me. I brought him treats, and I brushed him every day. And sometimes, when I rode him, I dropped the reins on his neck and just let him wander around the pasture however he liked. When I stood at the corner gate and called his name, he came right to me every time, and he stood without being tied while I brushed him and put his bridle on. I knew he liked me. He really did. But he wouldn't go faster, no matter what. He wouldn't run, and until he would run, I knew we'd never be able to jump. I was afraid Lady Thornton hadn't meant it when she said I could ask Mr. Grimes for help. But in the end, I decided I had to take the chance. "I'm going to visit Mr. Grimes," I said at lunch one day. It was a cold day. I was glad to be wearing one of Maggie's old sweaters. Miss Smith gave me an eye.
"How and why?"
"I'll ride Butter," I said. Miss Smith stared. "I do ride him quite a bit," I said. "We get on well. He's a very nice pony. He wouldn't mind taking me there."
"Ada," Miss Smith said, "I may be negligent, but I am not blind. I'm well aware how much you ride that pony."
"Yes, miss," I said.
"I've told you to call me Susan," she said. "Your refusal to do so is starting to feel like an affront. Why do you want to visit Mr. Grimes?"
"I just want to," I said. "He was nice to me."
"Susan," I added. She rolled her eyes. "And?" she prompted.
"And I'm having trouble with Butter, and I don't know what I'm doing wrong. I can't hardly get him to move. Miss the Iron Face, I mean Maggie's mum."
"Lady Thornton," prompted Miss Smith.
"Yeah, her. She said if I had trouble, I could ask Mr. Grimes for help."
Miss Smith picked up a piece of carrot with her fork. She put it into her mouth and chewed slowly.
"It hardly sounds like Butter," she said. "When I rode him, he was quite keen, and he's not gotten that much older."
She picked up another piece of carrot.
"All right," she said, after she chewed it and swallowed. "You may go. Do you remember how to get there?"
I nodded. It was easy, just the two turns, plus there was a fancy fence and iron gates at the start of the drive. Couldn't miss those. Miss Smith said, "If you're going to be riding out on the road, it might be better if you put a saddle on him. You could take the right stirrup off, so it wouldn't bang against his side." She knew I wouldn't be able to use the right stirrup. It would hurt too much.
"Is his the little one?" I asked.
There were three saddles in the storage room, hung on racks and covered with cloth. Two were the same size, and one was smaller.
"Yes," Miss Smith said. "I'll show you."
"It's all right," I said. "I don't need you."
She looked at me for a long time. "I never know what to do for the two of you," she said at last.
"I should have gone to Jamie's school earlier. I probably should supervise you more, but you'd hate it, wouldn't you?"
I didn't think this was the sort of question that needed an answer. I got up and scraped my plate into the trash, then filled the sink with soapy water to do the dishes.
"Will you at least tell me if you're having trouble? Ask if you need help."
I didn't look at her.
"I won't need help," I said.
Behind me, Miss Smith sighed.
"Have it your way," she said at last.
The saddle was awkward, but I got it on him. I started to climb on, and the whole saddle shifted to one side. I got off, put it right, and tightened the girth again. It had gone loose. I didn't know why. The second time I climbed aboard, it stayed steady. We went through the gate and ambled down the road. The airfield no longer showed any traces of the explosion or the burned plane. Jamie had said 3 people died, but he didn't know them. In the last week, more huts had gone up at the airfield, and one big tower that no one knew what was for. Planes sat parked in rows at the far side of the runway, and one plane kept coming toward the runway, touching down for a moment, and then rising into the air again. Round and round in loops. Butter barely flicked an ear at it. To him, planes landing and taking off had become common as trees. Partway down the road, Butter balked and wanted to turn and go back home. I made him continue. He went stubborn after that, mouthing the bit and flicking his ears at me, as though cursing me in some low hoarse language. He walked slower than ever, and I thought with longing of Jonathan's horse. A month ago, I'd been thrilled with Butter, and now I wanted something more. 2 months ago, I'd not seen trees. Eventually, we made it to Maggie's house, and around to the stable yard. Mr. Grimes was there in the yard, rinsing a big grey horse with water from a bucket.
"Aye," he said when he saw me.
"Aye," I said back, suddenly feeling shy. He hadn't said I could visit, only Maggie's mum had said that, and maybe Mr. Grimes wouldn't like it. I slid off Butter and put my right foot behind my left. Mr. Grimes looked me up and down.
"Wait there," he said.
He put the horse he was tending into a stall.
"Now," he said, coming toward me, "explain what you were doing riding this poor animal down the road."
"I wanted help," I said. "I can't make him go."
"I should think not."
He bent toward Butter's forefeet.
"Hasn't had his feet trimmed in years, has he?" "Bet not since that other one died, that Miss Becky."
He stalked off and came back with his hands full of metal tools.
"You just told him," he said.
He cradled Butter's hoof upside down in his hand, and then with a sort of pincher thing, he cut Butter's hoof right off. I screamed, Butter startled. Mr. Grimes straightened, dropping Butter's foot. Butter still had quite a bit of hoof left, I saw. But the cut-off part lay on the cobbled yard, curved and thick and horrible-looking. Mr. Grimes said,
"Does it look like I'm hurting him?"
It didn't. I couldn't believe it. Butter stood perfectly calm.
"Ponies' hooves are like our fingernails," he said.
He picked up another tool and rasped Butter's short hoof smooth. "They grow and they have to be trimmed." Miss Smith was a bear for having our fingernails trimmed. She'd trimmed them the second day we were with her, and our toenails too. And she kept on us to trim them every week, with clippers, not just nibbling off the broken bits like I was used to. It was strange, but Mr. Grimes was right. It didn't hurt.
"His are so overgrown, they're hurting him," Mr. Grimes continued, moving on to Butter's other front foot.
Probably hurts him to walk at all, and he couldn't really go faster, not without tripping himself. He's showing sense. This ought to make a big difference."
I felt stung. I'd been hurting him, and I didn't know.
"Some people shouldn't own ponies," Mr. Grimes said, as though echoing my thoughts. Then he looked at me. "I don't mean you," he said, "coming from London and being your age and all. How could you know? But that Miss Smith, she just threw the pony into the field once she'd told Miss Becky's hunters, and she's never looked at him again as far as I can tell."
"She told me ponies could do fine just eating grass."
"Aye, that's true. But it's not the only thing they need. If someone gave you enough to eat, but didn't keep you clean or healthy, or ever show you any kind of love, how would you feel?"
I said, "I wouldn't feel hungry." Mr. Grimes laughed.
"Well, that's so."
When he was finished, he said, "You bring him back here in 4 weeks or so, so I can trim him again. Usually you'd say every 6 weeks, but we'll have a bit of work to do before he's back to normal. Ordinarily, the village farrier'd do it, but he enlisted last week." I nodded, searched my head for the right words to say. Found them. "Thank you very much, Mr. Grimes." His eyes crinkled, but he didn't smile. He pulled off his hat, revealing a nearly bald head, and scratched himself behind one ear.
"It's just Grimes," he said. "Mr. Grimes, that would be if I were a butler, or something important like. But if we're going to be friends, you can call me Fred."
"Fred," I held out my hand, the way the colonel had. Fred shook it.
"And you're?" he prompted.
"Ada," I said. "Ada Smith, but just Ada to you." Fred took me all around the pony. He cut Butter's long, tangled mane.
"Normally we'd pull it, not cut it, but this mess is hopeless."
And showed me how to start untangling his tail. He taught me how to clean the saddle and bridle, and how to oil them over and over with tiny dollops of oil on a rag.
"You keep doing that," he said, "and any other tack you see at Miss Smith's, you oil that too. Leather dries out. It'll be ruined if it goes neglected much longer."
Then he told me he had to get on working.
"Too much to do these days," he said. "We've had to put the hunters back to grass. Too much for one man to keep 'em legged up and properly strapped and all. And anyways, there's no hunting with the war on. But even still, it's nearly all I can do caring for 13 horses."
"I can help," I said.
"Aye, I'd be grateful," he said.
We'd already put Butter into an empty stall while I worked on the tack. I helped grain, hay, and water the horses, Badfoot and all, and he didn't say a word about my limping or expect me not to be able to do things. When we were finished, I saddled and bridled Butter. Fred gave me a leg into the saddle. "Maggie said horses could have clubfoot," I said. "She said you could fix it." I tried not to feel hopeful.
"Aye," he said. "In horses you fix it with special shoes. It's not like clubfoot in people, though, I don't think. That's what you've got?"
I nodded.
"Can't help you," he said. "But I'll help you otherwise, whenever you like. You come back."
I went down the drive. I turned left at the road, which I knew was correct, but after that I'm not sure what happened. It should have been easy to find Miss Smith's house. Instead, I got lost. Chapter 22. Seeing the ocean was like seeing grass for the first time. I'd been lost for a while, wandering unfamiliar lanes. When I first realized I didn't know where I was, I tried to retrace my steps back to Maggie's, but I ended up somewhere else entirely. I tried letting Butter show me the way, but every time I gave him his head, he put it down and started to graze.
He was no use. I kept moving, searching for something familiar. Finally, I saw a long, tall hill and climbed it, thinking perhaps I could recognize Miss Smith's house, or at least the village, from above. Instead, I saw, stretched out in the distance, an endless carpet of blue and grey. Clouds floated over it, and small white things seemed to flicker on the surface of it. But mostly, it was like grass, flat and broad and unchanging, except that it went on forever, farther out than I could see. It made me feel lost and shivery looking at it. I stared and stared. What could it be? Eventually, I pulled my gaze down from it, and there was the village. I recognized the church spire. So close to that grey-blue expanse. How had I not known? I made my way down the hill, scrabbling through rough, tall grass, but keeping Butter's head in the direction of the steeple. Then we found a road and kept going. Pretty soon I was riding right along the middle of the main street. The village was quiet, the shops all shut up. The sky was getting dark, and of course not a light showed anywhere. Above me came the roar of an airplane. At home, Miss Smith and Jamie rushed out the door when they saw Butter and me walking up the lane. "I didn't mean to," I said. "I got lost." Miss Smith said, "I thought you'd fallen off that pony and were lying dead in a ditch somewhere." Jamie's face went white. "I wouldn't have died," I said. I went around to the back to take care of Butter. Jamie helped me. "How was school?" I asked. He shrugged. "Teacher let you use your left hand?" "Only because Susan made her. She still thinks I've got the mark of the devil." He held my hand as we walked back to the house. "When you were here, Susan didn't say you were dead in a ditch. She said you were probably having a nice time and I shouldn't worry." He paused. "She was worried, though. I could tell." I snorted. "She doesn't need to worry, nor you." Dinner was waiting. I fell to eating, so hungry that for a few minutes I didn't think of anything else. Then I said, "I saw something strange from the top of the hill. Far away, like grass, stretched out a long way, and flat, but different, blue and grey. When the sun hit it, it looked shiny." "That's the ocean," Miss Smith said. "The English Channel. I told you before we weren't far from it." I stared at her. I wanted to say she hadn't told me anything. I wanted to say she'd crippled my pony, ignoring him. I wanted to say she should have showed us the ocean. She should have taken us there. I wanted to say she never needed to worry about either of us. She didn't need to bother. I could take care of Jamie, and I could take care of myself. I always had. I wanted to say a lot of things, but, as usual, I didn't have the words for the thoughts inside my head. I dropped my head and went back to eating. "Did Grimes help you?" Miss Smith asked. "Yes," I said, rudely, through a mouthful of food. "Why wouldn't Butter trot?" I swallowed. I took a deep breath. I said, "Because you crippled him." Miss Smith looked up, sharp. "Explain." I didn't want to talk, but eventually she got the whole story out of me. She sighed. "Well, I am sorry. It was ignorance, not deliberate abuse. But that's never an excuse, is it?" She reached out to pat my arm, but I jerked away. "I understand why you're angry with me," she said. "I'd be angry too." After dinner, she marched me out to the pasture. She made me show her what Butter's feet looked like now, and tell her how they had been. She made me tell her what else Grimes had taught me, and then she went into the storage room and looked at all the tack.
"It's awful having to face your own shortcomings," she said. "Did Butter feel better after he had his feet fixed?"
"They're not fixed," I said. "They won't be fixed for weeks and weeks. And I don't know how he felt. I got lost."
She nodded. "You must have been scared. Scared and angry."
"Of course not," I said,
though I had been, at least until I'd seen the sea.
"Of course I wasn't scared."
"Angry," Susan said, putting her arm around me.
"No,"
I said through clenched teeth. But I was. Oh, I was.
Chapter 23 The Royal Oak sank. She was a Royal Navy battleship. She was torpedoed by a German submarine while anchored off the coast of Scotland, and 833 of the over 1,200 men on her died. We heard about it on the radio, which we listened to most nights. The next Saturday, Susan decided to take us to the movies. It was the first time Jamie and I had ever been. We sat down on the plush seats, like our purple chairs at home, and before we knew it, the whole wall in front of us had become a giant moving picture. Music played, and a man's voice started to talk about the war. I thought we were going to watch a story, not stuff about the war. Other than the silly posters and the sandbags that lay piled near some of the road intersections, you'd hardly know there was a war. Hadn't been any bombs. But now here was a picture of an enormous ship rolling onto its side while black smoke poured out of holes in its hull. The picture was so big and so horrible, and it got worse when the solemn voice talking about the Royal Oak said that over 100 of the dead were young boys. I looked at Jamie sitting on Susan's other side. "I want to go home," I whispered.
"Shh," Susan said. "The newsreel will be over in a minute. Then they'll show the story."
"I want to go home," I said more loudly.
"Don't start," Susan said.
"Don't start,"
Jamie echoed. I didn't, but I plugged my ears and I shut my eyes, and I stayed that way until Susan nudged me to let me know the story picture was starting. Even then I couldn't quit thinking about the burning ship and the boys that died. I had nightmares from the pictures. Jamie wet the bed, but he always did, every night still. I had dreams of fire and smoke and being tied to my chair, my little chair in our flat at home. I couldn't walk and I couldn't move and I screamed. Jamie woke and cried and Susan came at a run. "So, that was a little too overwhelming?" Susan said the next morning. She looked tired and cross, but she usually looked cross in the mornings. I avoided her gaze. I didn't know what she meant by overwhelming. "A little too much?" Susan said.
"Of course it was too much. It was 833 men too much."
Susan sighed. "Next time we go to the movies, we'll wait in the lobby until the newsreel's over. I assume that the radio's still okay?" I nodded. The radio didn't come with pictures. Jamie told Susan his teacher still thought he had the devil in him, and because of that we had to start going to church on Sundays.
"Of course you haven't got the devil in you," she said.
"But if you go, it'll give the gossips one less thing to talk about. Besides, I've been feeling guilty about neglecting your religious education." She made us go, but she didn't.
She went the first time only, to show us how you had to sit in the pew and stay quiet, unless there was singing or words to say, in which case we still sat quiet because we didn't know the songs or the words. A man up front read stories and then talked a long time, and Jamie got in trouble for kicking the pew. That was what the benches were called. Pews.
Jamie thought it was a funny word. The whole next week he held his nose and said, "Pew," every time he sat down.
After the first Sunday, Susan walked us to the church, then took a walk through the village and picked us up on her way back. She said churches and her didn't agree.
"You said your father worked in the church," I said, scowling, on our way home the second Sunday. The lady beside Jamie and me had spent the whole sitting down part of the service staring at us, and I hadn't liked it at all.
Miss Smith looked tight-lipped.
"Yes, my father has made it clear he doesn't think I can be redeemed."
Jamie said, "What's that mean, redeemed?"
"In my case, being redeemed means changing my evil ways and regaining my heavenly crown. It means my parents don't like me. And yes, my father's still alive. My mother died."
"Oh."
Jamie threw a rock and hit a fence post half a block away.
"Our mam doesn't like us either. Especially Ada. She hates Ada. Ada's not redeemed."
I flinched.
"Maybe I am now. Maybe now I can walk."
"Not without crutches," Jamie said. "You've still got that ugly foot."
"Jamie," Susan said, "you apologize."
Jamie said, "But she does."
"Her foot isn't ugly," Miss Smith said. "What a horrid thing to say. And Ada, you've done nothing wrong. Your foot is not your fault. You don't need to be redeemed."
I watched the tips of my crutches as we went down the road. Crutches, good foot. Crutches, good foot. Ugly foot, skimming along in the air. Always there, no matter what anyone said.
Chapter 24.
Butter galloped. He trotted first, and that was so bouncy I had to hold on to his mane so I didn't fall off. But I kept kicking him, and he trotted faster and faster, until suddenly everything evened out, and he was cantering. If I kept kicking him from there, he went faster still, until my eyes watered and the wind made noise in my ears. That was galloping. It was the best. I tried to jump the stone wall of Butter's pasture. I galloped him the length of the field, hard as I could, and steered him right toward the wall. He got close, closer, then slammed his feet into the ground. He stopped dead. I kept going, straight over his ears. I missed hitting the base of the wall, but not by much. Susan came running into the field. I hadn't known she was watching me.
"Stop that, you idiot," she said.
I looked at her. Butter was snorting and tossing his head, and I figured I'd better have another go at the wall quickly before I lost my nerve.
"You don't have the first clue what you're doing," Susan continued.
"You get on over to Fred Grimes and get him to teach you something before you get yourself killed. Putting that poor pony at a 3-foot wall when he's hardly ever jumped in his life."
"He hasn't?" I asked.
I figured all horses knew how to jump walls. Jonathan's horse hadn't had any trouble with it.
"He hasn't," she said. She rubbed the end of Butter's nose. "You'll hurt him if you aren't careful. You'll scare him, and that'll put him off jumping forever. Not to mention what it might do to you."
She should talk about hurting the pony.
Ignoring him until he was practically crippled.
He'd been better as soon as his hooves were trimmed. Better the very next day.
"Yes, I know what you're thinking," she continued. "But I know what he needs now, and I won't hurt him again. You know what you need now, too, because I'm telling you. You get on over to Fred Grimes."
So I went on over to see Fred in the stables behind Maggie's house. He agreed to watch me ride, and help me, for a bit of time after his lunch 2 days a week. In exchange, I'd work for him the rest of the afternoon. Susan gave me a map she'd drawn, and showed me how to trace my route on it, so I wouldn't be lost again.
I tied my crutches to the back of the saddle, so I had them for doing chores. Fred taught me to kick less. He taught me to use one leg only to ask for a canter, so that I didn't have to get bounced by the trot. He tried to teach me to post to the trot, to rise and fall to the motion smoothly, without bouncing. But that was hard with only one stirrup. He taught me more about steering, and when he was happy with my progress, he set up little poles in the field beyond the stable yard, and had me practice going over them. It was a long way from jumping the stone wall. Fred said I wasn't to try that on Butter until he told me I was ready. Stephen White's colonel sent another invitation to tea. I declined. "Idiot girl," Susan grumbled. Meanwhile, the war had become an endless stream of pamphlets the government sent through the mail. How to wear your gas mask? Why to carry your gas mask? How not to get hit by a car in the blackout? You could carry a flashlight if you covered over the glass with tissue paper. You should paint curbs white so the people driving the cars could see them. Why you should give the government your excess pots and pans. They wanted to make planes from them. Susan refused to do it. She said she had exactly as many pans as she needed. This made Jamie so upset that eventually she relented and gave him an old nasty chip pan to turn in. There weren't any bombs. What there were was German submarines circling all of England, trying to blow up any ships heading in or out of her harbours. This was a big problem, Susan said, because England didn't grow enough food. Most of the food English people ate was shipped in from other countries. Already there was less food in the shops, and what was there cost more, though Susan said some of that was because the summer was over. We wouldn't see as many fresh fruits and vegetables until next spring. You never saw anyone more interested in fruits and vegetables than Susan. We were all the time having to eat strange things. Brussels sprouts, turnips, leeks, peaches, which I loved, but also prunes, which I didn't. Prunes came in cans and were slimy going down. Every week that went by without bombs, more evacuees returned to London. Even the ones living with Lady Thornton had gone. In the village, Lady Thornton fussed about it, but she couldn't stop parents from sending for their children. "London will be bombed," she insisted. Mam never wrote, so Susan was still stuck with us. When I said so, she gave me an odd look. "Your mother's smart to keep you here, where it's safer," she said. "But I wish she'd answer my letters. I find her silence hard to understand." By the start of November, so many children had returned to London that Jamie's teacher left too. His class was combined with the other primary class. His new teacher didn't think he had the devil in him. She said so. She didn't care at all if he wrote with his left hand. He still wet the bed. I thought it was mostly habit by now. Susan had a rubber sheet to protect the mattress, but she was tired of cleaning the regular sheets. I was tired of waking up to the dampness and the smell. Neither of us said so to Jamie. He was ashamed, I knew. Lady Thornton wanted Susan to join the Women's Volunteer Service, the WVS. She came to tea and told Susan she needed her help. "No one needs my help," Susan said. "Besides, I'm busy taking care of these children." Lady Thornton cut her eyes at me. Jamie was at school, but I'd come in from the pasture to have tea. It wasn't one of my days for helping Fred.
"This one doesn't seem to need much care," Lady Thornton said.
"You'd be surprised," Susan said.
I felt cross. I didn't need her. Plus, she still spent part of each day lying around, staring at nothing. I said, "It's not like you have a proper job."
Susan glared at me. Lady Thornton laughed out loud. Then Lady Thornton said, gesturing to the sewing machine still set up in the corner of the room, We could use you to sew bed jackets for